We all have a story to tell. Let's tell yours. Welcome to the Intellectual People Podcast with your host, Jason. Come together and listen to journey stories and more from interesting people. Welcome your host, Jason.
I often post on various audio forums, and I want to take this time to just thank them. In no particular order, they are audioscienceReview.com, audioroundtable.com, audiocircle.com, audioshark.org, audiophilestyle.com, avnirvana.com, diyaudio.com, gearspace.com, and the Parts Express forum. Thank you so much, and I really appreciate your viewership and enjoy. Today on the Intellectual People Podcast, I have Ethan Weiner. How are you doing today, Ethan?
I'm doing great. Thanks.
Very well. So we have ethanweiner.com, and then you're also part of realtraps.com, and we'll get into that further, correct?
Yep.
Okay. Ethan, tell me how you started your career.
Well, my career, I've had a lot of careers. I started playing the violin in fourth grade, and like that, I always liked music. My parents had a record player, but it was fine. You know, it was okay for a middle-class family. And my mother was big on music. She has talent. My father had no musical talent at all. But my mother had the ability, which thankfully I inherited. And so I was exposed to, early on, a classical music, the great violin concertos, which I still really, really like, and cello concertos and a lot of classical music. And then somewhere in my early teens, like most kids, and this was in the 60s, early 60s, the Beatles and pop music, and I started playing the guitar and really liked that. And I noticed that some days, and I work really hard at everything I do, and I really work really hard on the guitar. And I noticed that some days, you play better than others. And so I, learned at that point, the guitar players would learn the Ventures songs. And so I'd learn something, I'd play it good. And I'd say, so the next day a friend would come over and I'd say, hey, listen to this. And I wouldn't be doing it as good. So I really liked the idea of recording, being able to record when you're playing well. Of course, once you're a real professional, you can play well every day. But, as a kid. So I really liked the idea of recording, and bought a Sony two-track stereo recorder, quarter-inch tape, and it had sound-on-sound capability. You could record on the left channel and then record something new on the right channel while blending in what was on the left, and now you have both things on the right. And could copy that back. And of course, after about three generations, it sounded horrible. It had some distortion. And a couple years later, or maybe a year later, I bought a second stereo Sony tape recorder and bought a four-track head and made a four-track recorder out of the first one and ran wires from the second one. And that was a big investment. I remember that four-track head. It was a combination record playhead, cost me $100. And that was a lot of money back in those days.
Sure.
So that was how I got started in this. And then I was really into electronics and ham radio for a little while. I didn't find talking to people by Morse code very fun. I've had the good fortune. Excuse me. I've had the good fortune to have people who were nice enough to help me. I have an older sister. She's 5 years older. And her boyfriends, several of them were like electronics guys. So when I wanted to build Fuzztone for myself, he said, oh, you take these two transistors and a 9-volt battery. And so that was that was a combination of recording and music and electronics.
And did you go to college?
Well, yes and no. I was always self-taught, and by self-taught, I mean, yes, some of that's reading books and magazines and Popular Electronics magazine, but getting tutored by by older people. And I worked in electronics starting when I was, I think, 17 or 18. And there were real engineers there that would answer my questions. But I never went to school for this. And when I was 28, I was working at an electronics company that made precision crystal oscillators, which is a really cool product. And I wanted to just have a college experience. So they were nice enough to let me work part-time for 2 years, and I went to the University of Bridgeport and took everything you'd need to get a degree in music, except for history, social studies, a foreign language, and you know, all the other stuff. And I did very well. I had a 3.8 average because I was, you know, an adult at that point and very motivated. So that's my only college. I've never had college for electronics, but there's lots of books. And of course, now there's everything is on the internet.
Right. What did you do in those years then at your 22, 23, 24? Or did you just said you were 28 actually when you went?
Well, at that point, yeah. Well, I was always making things and making, you know, like say fuzzstones and compressors and effects for guitar. And I was always into recording. And I had friends come over and we, you know, I had, I think, three of those. Well, at the time, there were $30 Radio Shack electric condenser mics, and they were good. I mean, for back then, you know, there were real condenser mics, and so had I think three of them, and I made a mixing console. I had a friend. This was 1970, so it would have been 22 at that time, and he had a barn on his parents' property. And we turned that into a studio with actual control room and a live room and a vocal booth. It's a big, big barn. You know, it could have been a four-car garage. And we bought a four-track Ampex, you know, a real tape recorder. And I made a recording console with preamps and stuff that I designed myself. Mm-hmm. And it was pretty primitive, you know, bass and treble controls. And
did you enjoy playing or recording more?
I like both. And now I've had several recording studios, and I'll get to the answer because it's maybe an interesting answer.
Yeah.
The first studio was in my friend Jim's barn, and we recorded bands for $25 an hour. And this was the early 70s. And then around 1975, we hooked up with another fellow who invested a 16-track. He bought a used 16-track MCI 2-inch. Recorder, and I built a serious recording console, a real console, and that took 2 years to build. It took about a year to design and 2 years to build. And we had a studio in the what had been a dairy, not factory, but it was a huge freezer. It was a really big room. That was the live room. And we did a lot of stuff. This partner who bought the tape recorder had a lot of contacts in the advertising industry. He had a friend who was an exec at a Rhode Island advertising agency, and we did jingles for the Connecticut Lottery. We did the state theme song for Rhode Island, and lots of stuff, you know, real stuff. We recorded some, some almost famous people. And Narada Michael Walden was on the way up at that point, and we recorded him and other bands. And then later we took on a third partner whose father was very wealthy. And we got a real studio. I mean, serious. It was the biggest studio in Connecticut at the time. I don't think there's ever been anything bigger. That was 1980. So I was always, you know, doing these kinds of things. But to answer your question, I really like playing and I like recording myself. I didn't so much like recording others. I would tire very quickly of hearing the same stupid guitar solo over and over and over. Oh, wait, one more time. I can do it. You know, and you know, it was just, you know, yeah. It wasn't that interesting. But what I would do is we would do projects, a lot of jingles and a lot of industrial music for companies. And I wrote a number of them also. We did for Pitney Bowes, and we did for Stanley Tools and Kodak Cameras. And we did, you know, a lot of stuff for the, you know, for big companies. So we would do these projects, and I would play the bass and lead guitar. One of the other partners, the one with the wealthy father who invested real money into this, is a very good drummer and a really good recording engineer, better than me, and we're still good friends. And the partner who bought the MCI was a keyboard player and acoustic guitar and a songwriter. So we would do these projects, And I would take, I would say, gee, I'm going to do a pop tune. I would, you know, something I was going to make up. So I would take the, just the drums, it'd be 8 tracks of drums or 6 or whatever. I'd bounce that down to stereo and then copy that back to tracks 15 and 16 of the 2-inch 16 track. And then I had 14 tracks. I could write a whole song, play piano and all these things. That was the most fun. That I liked myself doing that more than recording other people.
What were the challenges other than what you've already discussed of recording?
It's always a challenge to get a good mix and to get, you know, to get good sounds in the first place. Even though I'm now 72, I think I'm doing better work now, better mixes and better recordings than I did back then. I doubt I can hear beyond 12 kilohertz. But you know, the meat of the recording is in the mid range and in the bass. And right. If you can't hear, you know, 16 kilohertz, who cares? Look at all these, there's some really well-known mastering engineers that are all my age, you know, Bob Katz and, Alan Silverstein, Silverman. So, and, you know, and they still turn out good work. So, you don't have to hear 16 kilohertz.
Sure. And do you think that it's more experience related while you're doing better work today than you did then? Or do you believe it's equipment and room and everything combined?
Well, certainly room, though the studio we had, the third studio, the big one, we hired acoustic consultants, Klepper, Marshall, and King from White Plains, New York. That's where I learned how to make bass traps and do acoustic treatment and learned about room modes and all that stuff.
Ah.
So yes, that's important. Of course, when you're close micing a guitar and the microphone's an inch in front of the speaker cabinet, the acoustics don't matter, but certainly drums and anything. Acoustic guitar and string instruments like the cello, you can't stick a mic really close to that. You have to get back 2, 3, 4 feet to capture the full range of sounds that comes out of these things. So that's when the acoustics of your bedroom studio, your untreated bedroom studio, just turn everything into a hollow, boxy sounding mess. But, you know, I didn't have the benefit of being a tape op or a runner for a real studio. So it took me many, many years to suss out what to do and how to do this. My friend Peter went to, I forget the name of it, but it was out west. He went to a recording class taught by one of the guys who was the producer of the band Chicago, and he learned a lot. And and probably the most important thing that I've learned that has really helped, and now look, everybody says this all the time, is you got to thin out the tracks. You got to high pass everything that doesn't need bass, because that's what makes your bass muddy, and that's what makes the tracks boomy. And then you also need bass traps in your control room, or at least second guess stuff, check stuff in the car or with earphones, because the nulls in every bedroom studio, the biggest problem is there's 1, 2, or 3 really bad nulls at 60 hertz, 80 hertz, 130 hertz. And that makes you don't hear the fullness. So you turn up the bass more than you should, and then you play it in the car, and now it's this big boomy mess. So that's the other half of it. But you got to thin the tracks. And I wish I knew that back then.
How did you get into room acoustics professionally?
Well, I'll tell you, when I learned all about bass traps, so these were old school bass traps that we built for this big studio. Now we use different materials and different type of traps. But I was irritated seeing the ads for first Sonics and then Oralex. And this was, I guess, in the 80s. And they would say, you know, tame your room. And they had these little tiny bass traps made out of foam that you would stick in the corner, and which is still what they sell. You know, they're 17 inches across the front face, which is just too small. And I just got so irritated that when I moved to this current house in the early 90s, I had a friend who's a good carpenter. So I had him make a bunch of these old school bass traps in the room that I'm in now. And I don't think you can see them in here. But and I approached Electronic Musician magazine. I said, you know, all this acoustic treatment stuff that's now becoming popular is really pretty lame. I'd like to do an article. I took photos as my friend was building all these traps with this in mind to do an article, and they thought it was a great idea. Huh. So I did an article. It's still on my website, ethanweiner.com. Though I have a disclaimer at the top saying, don't build this. This really isn't what you want. It's pretty good for really big rooms, but for home studios, this isn't what you want. And so that's how I got started with acoustics, was just being irritated at the, you know, the junk that was being sold to people.
So you write that article, and I presume that it goes off very well.
It did, yeah. That was 1995, and I still get lots of hits on that article.
It's really?
Been on my website since the year of my website.
And did Real Traps start because of that? Is that how
it did? Yeah. I was at one point. I had a detour in the 80s. I worked for an electronics company. After the studio, I actually had a falling out with the rich kid partner. Although now we're like best friends. And I went to work for an electronics company that does guided tours in museums and tourist attractions, where you have this little wand that you listen to as you walk around, and there were radio antennas under the floor. That was great. I got sent to Las Vegas a bunch of times, Bermuda 3 times, New Orleans, and I got stuck for 6 weeks in Beulah, North Dakota, in the middle of winter. Boy, that was awful. But that was really great. I worked for them for a few years, and then I got really interested in software when I had this big studio. It was just before the IBM PC came out. The Apple II was like the business computer, and you'd go to the app to the computer store, and these guys would be in 3-piece suits selling an Apple II computer with floppy disk drives, and software, accounting software, was like $2,000, which is yep. stupid even today for yep. you know, for accounting software. So I learned how to program and really liked that. That's another career. And I started a software company that was very successful, and ended up selling that to my partner after 5 years. And then, so I was kind of semi-retired, looking for something to do, and had another very good friend, Doug Ferrara, who I met when we were in our 20s at an electronics place, and he's an actual degree electronics engineer. And we kept talking about it for years. Geez, great to start a company selling bass traps. But these bass traps, these old school ones, are big wooden boxes, 8 feet tall, have to be glued together. It's supposed to be glued onto the wall. But we came up with a way to make a back and the way to hang them. And we sold those for about 6 months. And then we came up with something much better based on rigid fiberglass, which is really what is more appropriate. But we started Real Traps in 2003, almost 20 years ago.
Has Real Traps been successful?
It has, yeah. There are other companies that are bigger than us. And work harder. Right now, we don't need to grow. We're at a good size. Everybody's making money. Everybody's happy. Everybody's as busy as we want to be. I don't want to spend any more time for me. Doug and I actually sold the business 3 years ago to one of our employees. He wanted to retire and just stop completely. So we were going to just shut it down. And one of the guys who works for us, Sean, said, well, I don't want to lose my job. I'll get a loan and I'll buy it from you. So we sold him the business basically for the value of the inventory. And so I now work for him. But it's a part-time job. I work between 0 and 6 hours a day. If it's really busy, I'll work, you know, a lot.
And what do you do currently then for Real Traps?
Well, I'm the customer person. The 800 number comes to my home. I have, you know, two lines, and that's line two is that. I do all the email, and I do all the advising of people.
Wow.
And Sean runs the factory where everything is actually built and shipped from. And he's learning, but he couldn't do what I do. And I like what I do. Not that it's not, you know, that much work. But I don't want to work any harder. I do newsletters a couple times a year. I think, geez, I should do a newsletter. But yeah, I don't want more orders. I don't want more work.
You know? I'm sure Sean would disagree with that.
No, he's happy too. No, he's as busy as he wants to be. And if it gets busier, he's got to hire more people. And, you know, everybody's doing well. So we don't really care that other companies are growing more. And
what do you believe from all these years in business at Real Traps? What do you believe is the most misunderstood thing about room treatments?
The most misunderstood thing is people think it's really complicated, and it's not. I could teach anybody in half an hour everything I know, pretty much. I mean, you know, maybe not all the minutia, but it's not complicated at all. you got to treat the bass frequencies, which is done differently than reflections at mid and high frequencies, and where you put stuff, and people think, oh, you need a degree in physics to know how to treat a room. They also think you have to measure the room to know how to treat it, which isn't true. I mean, I've treated at this point thousands of rooms, and people send me pictures, and I say, oh, okay, well, you got a window there, so you're going to need a panel there, but we'll put it on the stand, or you could hang it from long wires from the ceiling or something. Right. Or maybe I'll tell people, gee, can you rotate 90 degrees? You really should be facing, this way here. And
do you believe, Ethan, that you should treat a studio different, like a mastering studio, different than a home audio two-channel room?
No, I think that the goals for stereo listening, mixing, home theater are all exactly the same.
Okay.
I have two setups. I have this large room here, which is 33 feet front to back, a high ceiling, and which is two channel. But I have a really nice home theater in my living room with surround, just 5.1. I don't have all the latest Dolby Atmos and,
sure.
Oh, geez, it's raining on the roof. I can hear it coming from up there. I don't care about that stuff. but the goals are the same. When you listen in your hi-fi listening room, you're an audiophile, you want to hear what the producer and the engineer and the artist heard.
Right.
That's what they signed off on, and that's a really accurate neutral room that doesn't have boxy sounding reflections from off a wall just a little bit off to the side. So you want to hear the same thing, so you'll get the full treatment of what they had and what they intended.
Do you agree that you can overdamp a room?
Not really. I mean, you don't have to cover every single surface 100%, and maybe that would sound bad. Usually when people do that, the reason it sounds bad is because they use thin foam that makes it, you clap your hands and it's just totally dead, but the bass is all boomy and indistinct and you can't hear the bass notes. And the jazz, walking bass, doing an ascending line, it's like playing bass notes on the piano with the pedal down and all the notes run together. So that's the problem. I think it's a myth. And I hear this all the time, both in home recording studios and small rooms and audiophiles. And, in a normal sized living room, it's not huge. I don't want my room to be totally dead. Actually, you do. Because when you have all these reflections from the floor, the ceiling, the sidewalls, they drown out the larger sounding ambience and reverb that's in the recording. If you put it in headphones, that's the largest, biggest, most spacious sound that you get, and the reverb isn't drowned out by the small sound of your small room with echoes bouncing around.
Would you say then, I don't want to tell you what I think you would say, but can you give us a rough idea for the average listening room what you would recommend and where and for what?
Oh, sure. Yeah. It's easy. First of all, the wall, let's not talk about one of these big open spaces that some condos and apartments are, where it's like 40 feet and the kitchen is way in the back and there's a dining area and, and there's an upstairs and it's all open. But let's just say a room. My living room is 25 feet front to back, 16 feet wide. And I also have a peak ceiling, but it's a room. It's a rectangle room.
Exactly.
The wall behind you is probably the worst reflections. The sound comes out of the speaker, goes past your head, and comes right back at you. So the wall behind you is probably the first line of attack. And that's at all frequencies. Everything comes back at you. Bass, mids, and highs, they all come back at you. But bass also goes back and forth, and also side to side and up and down, but mostly front. A lot of it's front to back, which should be the longest dimension in the room. That's how you should set up the room. So more bass traps in the front helps. And the corners kind of collect bass, just sort of like cupping your hand behind your ear or the way a satellite dish works. That same thing happens in a corner. So that's why corners are the most effective. But really the entire effective place for bass traps, but the whole back wall and the whole front wall too. And then the next thing is the what's called early reflections. And those happen well off the floor and the ceiling. Most loudspeakers are designed to send sound outward more than up and down, depending on the shape of the of the tweeter and how it's arranged. But that's usually the goal, is you should be able to move around left to right and still get a good response. There's no sense wasting energy going up to the ceiling or to the floor. But stuff still gets to the floor, so a carpet is good. Doesn't have to be wall to wall, but a nice thick rug halfway between you and the speakers. And, you know, halfway, it's like a cue ball on a pool table. And the same thing happens off the sidewalls. And that point's about halfway. It's actually a little forward of halfway. On the RealTrap site, there's all kinds of articles that show this, how to set up a room, and it tells you how to find the place. There's a thing, trick you can do with a mirror. There's a, you can calculate it. So those are the main things, is base trapping, you know, and reflections off the, and then reflections off the back wall and the sides. And that's it. I mean, it's not that complicated.
Do you recommend treating every ceiling?
Well, you know, in a mixing environment, if all you're doing is mixing, then really you just need the cloud overhead. And if you have a 10-foot ceiling, you might not even need that. Not a lot of sound's going to get up from the speakers all the way up to the ceiling and then back down to your ears. But a lot of people, you know, have a one-room studio in their bedroom, so they record vocals or percussion instruments or acoustic guitar further back. So in that case, it's good to have another cloud in the back. Especially if somebody, you know, somebody's 6 feet tall and they're only 2 feet below the ceiling and they're singing into a microphone, you know, some of the sounds are going to go up and come back down and get into the mic. So,
and what about a two-channel listening room in somebody's home? Would you still recommend a cloud there as well?
Well, yes, at the halfway point between you and the speakers.
Okay.
But not necessarily behind you. And I've had people say, well, gee, if I clap my hands, I hear this boinging sound. But what really matters is, what if you play hand claps through your speakers? Do you hear it then? Because if you're in the back of the room and it's a wood floor and a hard ceiling, you'll get that echoing, you know, back and forth resonance between the floor and ceiling. But that may not be a problem. But generally, it's good to treat the room anyway. My living room has... there's another article on the website called, you know, all about early reflections, and makes the point that, yeah, you do want your room dead mostly, but it shows all the, not counting the carpet, I have 18% of the surface area covered with panels. And okay. So you don't need to cover everything. You just have to hit the important points.
Are you a proponent and willing to help people if they want have that DIY bug because they can't afford or they're not willing to spend all of that money to buy commercially made products? Are you willing to help them construct their own?
I am. I don't do that for free. I'm the most affordable guy in the business. Most real acousticians will not talk to you for less than $3,000-$5,000. And the top name guys, they won't talk to you unless you got 10 or 20 grand. I have what I call flat rate consulting for $200. It's a generous hour. And it doesn't even have to all be in one session. And you could talk on the phone for half an hour, and you come back with more questions 2 weeks later. And I do a couple of those a month for people that don't have a lot of money. And I do that as a service.
And do you go to the other extreme of somebody that wants to build and design a room? Do you get into any of that?
Well, I stop short of outright room design with like architect type drawings. First of all, I'm not an architect. I know all the basics of soundproofing, and I learned all that also building the biggest studio in the, just before 1980 when we opened. But I don't have enough confidence that I would want to charge somebody money to do a new build and get it right. I'd rather they, you know, buy Roger Vase's book, that, you know, a $30 book tells you everything that you need to know, or hire somebody that really specializes in that. And also, I don't want to spend that much time. I'm not looking for big projects for people. I'm happy to spend an hour or two with someone if they pay me. And I get an endless stream of emails and private messages on Facebook asking questions. And I'll gladly answer a question. But what happens is it always turns into another. Well, while I got you here, you know, somebody was telling me, and next thing I know, I got to say, look, I really hate to do this, but, you know, this is what I do for a living, and I'm really affordable, you know. But yes, I'm happy to help people. And even when I was an owner of RealTraps, there's what I call the acoustics FAQ or FAQ on my Ethan Weiner website, not the Real Trap site. And it's really detailed. It's everything all about how to make all different kinds of bass traps and how to treat a room and what to do. And it's all for do-it-yourselfers. And I've had that all throughout the time I owned Real Traps. And I still help people with do-it-yourself information.
And I'll put all those links below in the description so everybody can go check them out. Ethan, you've been very vocal about a lot of electronics testing that has been done, and even to go as far as saying that the people that are so subjective just are wasting their money on so many things. Can you elaborate on that?
Oh, I sure can. The biggest problem with audiophiles and a lot of recording people too. I get in arguments with people that really should know better. I mean, people who are actually professional recording engineers about this stuff. The biggest problem is people don't realize how unreliable their own hearing really is. And everybody has had the experience, everybody that was recording people have had the experience where you tweak the EQ on the snare drum and it's perfect, and you realize you were tweaking the vocal track or something that wasn't even engaged. Or you do a mix and it sounds really great, and the next day you fire it up and it sounds awful. And that's so common. Hearing memory is very short, and it's just not reliable. Acoustics is also a big issue. There's an article on my personal site that shows the response, how it changes 4 inches away. And this was in an untreated bedroom size space. And I was actually measuring something else, and I measured here and then moved the mic 4 inches. And the response is completely different, even at really low frequencies. People say, well, the wavelength at 40 hertz is like 12 feet. You'd have to move 12 feet. No, because there's so many competing reflections all coming together, making, peaks and nulls all over. So if you sit there and you listen to your stereo, and then you change your speaker wires and you sit down over here now, you really are getting a different response. There really is a difference. I don't think that's the main reason, but that's one thing. But mostly it's just wishful thinking, placebo effect. And it's easy to prove this stuff. That's what's so distressing to me, is that I'm really calm in my and non-judgmental and non-insulting. And I explain to people I have all kinds of proof, that's just irrefutable proof, that 4 different RCA wires, ranging from the free stuff you get to a $900 wire, $800 wire, all pass audio exactly the same. And the expensive wire has an arrow on it saying, what works this way? So I reversed it and proved beyond any doubt, it's irrefutable proof that they all pass audio exactly the same. And people still say, well, you're not measuring the right thing. And I explain why it's irrefutable. It's called the null test. And, so there's so much arrogance that people don't realize that, they should be following the science rather than subjective opinion in hi-fi magazines.
How do you believe that can improve?
Education, I guess. I've had this idea for 10 years. It'll probably never happen, a pie-in-the-sky idea. I wanted to write a book called If I Were the King. And if I were the king, we would start in the first grade teaching logic and consumerism and basic psychology, how to get along with people. Lots of stuff like that. So, so education starting early on and of logic and basic consumerism. But, electronics has gotten so good. When I was doing this stuff in the 60s and 70s and buying equipment, it was the mid-70s with the second studio where we had a real console I built, and we had U87s and, AKG 414s, all the really good stuff and all the high-end outboard gear. You really had to pay a lot of money to get a good microphone and to get good outboard gear. Now with op amps and with surface mount stuff and just the advances in technology and materials, and of course with the inexpensive labor in Asia, you can get really, really good stuff for really cheap. Most plugins are fine. All the equalizers sound the same. There's an article I post a link to often where this guy tested like 25 different equalizer plugins. And other than when they add like analog grit or you overdrive it to get some mojo, just the basic thing, because there's like one or two designs that they teach in DSP college, if you take this actually in real college, and all the equal, and it's the same with the analog. They all use state variable filters, a parametric equalizer, or some minor variant of a state variable filter. So they all work pretty much the same. But with the plugins, they all have, you know, they're all the same thing. And people think, oh, this one's sweeter, and this one's got, you know, whatever. So, right. And you can now get microphones. I get people really angry when somebody. And I like to go into the like the student audio recording groups and help them. These are people with no money. You really need to know what's worth buying and what's not worth buying. Well, gee, I want to buy a really good mic for my vocals or for rapping. I really, it's all rapping now. So I say, one of the best values, and there's lots of mics, and I don't know all. There's 1,000 of them. I bet you there's 1,000 models of microphones that you could buy in pro audio or home recording stores. But I tell people, one of the best values is the Audio Technica 2020. It's $100 and it's like literally like getting a U47 for $100. And boy, does that make people mad. You know, but it is. I mean, it really is. It's a fantastic microphone and there's lots of them that are, you know, $60, $100, $150, large diaphragm condensers that are really clean and really good, extended response, and you get up close to them and they sound really full and great like Elvis.
Yeah. What are your thoughts on recording in DSD?
Oh, I can't see any point to that.
Really?
PCM at 16 bits and 44 kilohertz does everything you need. And I understand people like to use 24 bits because you can be sloppy with record levels. And, you know, when I was doing this stuff and we had tape and even with DBX or Dolby noise reduction, you still had to be careful with levels. So to me, it's not a big deal to get within in the ballpark. I do everything at 16 bits. I just, and the room tone, the room noise is always worse. I once accidentally recorded an electric guitar overdub from my amplifier and it got recorded at minus 30. And this was with 16 bits. And I raised it up, you know, in SoundForge, and still the dominant noise was hum from the amplifier. I mean, not much, but that's what was there. So you can, I see no reason to go DSD and the SACDs, I think, is what uses that. They have some problems. I mean, they have like really loud noises at ultrasonic frequencies that if you don't filter them out, it gets thrown out your tweeters. And I just don't see a point because PCM does what it's supposed to. It does it cleanly. It does it clearly. It does it easily and very well. It's a very mature science, and I can't see a need for anything better.
Then why do I can think of two studios, one I interviewed actually on this channel, then why would those studios be such proponents of DSD?
I have no idea, but it's probably the same flawed thinking where they think that their own hearing, you know, they don't realize that their hearing isn't as reliable. You know, every recording session is different. Mm-hmm. And I remember when I was doing this, one time recording, it was, believe it or not, a big band polka band. Huh. And they were great. I mean, they were really good. I just put the microphones in front of, you know, the trombones and the, you know, the mic over the drums, you know, just did it as normal. And it just sounded great before anything else was done, compression, EQ or anything, because the arrangements were good, the musicians were good, and the room was good. And it just was fine. Other sessions, I remember doing, I used to teach also. That was another way you made money, was I taught aspiring recording engineers at this biggest studio. And so we would get bands in for free. You know, we'd say, we'll record you for free if you don't mind getting recorded by a bunch of students. And we'll make sure you get a decent mix in the end for your effort.
Right.
And I remember this one band that had a keyboard player, and he was pounding out, he was a Elton John wannabe, and he was pounding out all this stuff like in the octave below middle C. So it was just this big muddy mess, and it was just pounding from start to finish of the song, you know. Well, it's really hard, and if you listen to some of the early Elton John stuff, the piano is really thin. I mean, it's really thin. Yep. Because otherwise it would compete with the kick and the toms and the electric bass. Right. But so that was a lot of work to make that session sound good. So my point is that people will, if you're a mastering engineer, you get a project in the master and it already sounds good. And, you know, so you try this converter on it and you say, wow, that sounds great. Well, it already sounded great, you know, and then you try it on another project. So the issue is people don't know how to compare properly. I'm sorry. That's really the short answer. I wrote an article for Live Sound International magazine about how to do a proper listening test. You know, measuring usually is what you want. That's really the best way to find stuff. But sometimes you can't tell, like MP3 compression rates. You just can't tell. You have to do a listening test, but it has to be blind. The article was so detailed and went into so many, there were so many points to be made that they had to split it across two issues. And that's on my website. Well, it's a link to their website. And it's, you know, and tells you have to be correct 6 times in a row at least. Because if you say, well, listen to this, which one is the MP3? You know, here's a WAV file, here's an MP3, which is which? Right. People can, you know, 50-50, you guess right. You have to be 66 times in a row to be, I think it's 95 or 96% confident that you really could hear a difference.
What percentage of Realtrap's business is professional versus home studio, not studio, but home listening room?
Well, I've never done the stats, but just it seems that it's about 50-50.
Is it?
We do professional studios. I've been sold to some of the biggest studios and also a lot of home studios and a lot of hi-fi rooms and a lot of home theaters. So there's really 4 different kind of categories, and it's, you know, approximately the same, you know, 20, 30, 25, you know.
Sure.
Somewhere.
Does Realtrap, in terms of, I think from a consumer level, it's important that people understand what's different. So there's a few large, well-known companies, right? Well, let's leave out the companies that you already mentioned, but the go-to home audiophile acoustic treatment companies. What separates them from Realtraps? Why should somebody buy a Realtraps over company X, or why should someone buy X over you?
Right. Somebody should buy, well, I call them the cheap knockoffs, which probably isn't fair, but though, you know, I'll pat myself on the back for really making acoustic treatment a thing these days. I've been working at this now since 1995, so that's 25 years. Every day in audio forums, it started off in CompuServe, was before the internet and audio forums, and audio forums, and now there's a lot on Facebook, and it's all over the place. But I have been hammering at it and hammering at it. And when I started Realtraps, the big companies were ASC, the Tube Trap Company, and RPG. And RPG is huge. They're probably the biggest, you know, many millions of dollars a year in sales. And then Realtraps came out, and we were much cheaper. Our mini trap, bass trap, was $159 compared to the Tube Traps that were, you know, started at $600-$700 for the ones that were big enough to actually work. And then people started, basically making competing stuff for half the price, a third the price. And I'll tell you, and I can tell you exactly the difference. One of the biggest differences is me. I know more than all those people. Not more than the president of ASC or RPG. Those guys are real acousticians. But if you call RPG, you don't get the president. You get a salesperson. And at ASC, I don't know if you get Al Knoxon, but I give the best advice, and I give a lot of advice. And I give people advice on other stuff. I tell them, look, if you have questions about what, you know, gear to get and stuff, or if you just want some facts, you know, that's also one of the things I do. The downside of that is I've had people come to me and say, oh, I'm going to buy your stuff. I love your stuff. I'm totally. And I spend a lot of time, like an hour or more with them, telling them exactly what to get. And then all of a sudden, that's the last I hear from them. And they just wanted my advice for free. And then they go buy, you know, cheap knockoffs. But that doesn't happen too much. But the main advantage with our products is, first of all, we use genuine Owens Corning rigid fiberglass. That costs like a lot more than a mineral wall or rock wall that the other companies use. But it doesn't sag. If you hang something from the ceiling, it's not going to sag down. It doesn't turn to dust over time. If you pick them up and you move, you know, from one location to another, the mineral well and rock well, it's powdery. It turns to dust. Even foam does that after about 10 years. Huh. It can become flaky and just kind of fall apart. So we use much better material that costs a lot more than the other stuff. The frames are made out of metal with a nice powder coat, and there's a lot of connectivity on the back. They can be hung on the wall like a picture. They can be spaced off the wall, 3/4 of an inch, 3 inches, with mounting kits that we have, which the spacing increases their effectiveness. The crossbars that are on the back have threaded inserts for mounting on stands. They have slots that will take radiator hose clamps for mounting on poles, which is useful for large venues. They can have a big pole and they can hang them really easily with just radiator hose clamps and a power screwdriver. So there's a lot of connectivity. It's just a really high quality product. It doesn't, the powder coat doesn't flake off over time like one of our competitors who bought a whole pile of metalwork in China and had it all the paint fall off. So, and probably the most important thing is we have a proprietary membrane on the base traps. So we sell most of all our panel shaped things in two forms, either as base traps or as reflection absorbers. The base traps have this, it's a thin plastic membrane behind the front fabric that increases the base absorption quite a bit, 20-30%, and it reduces the absorption at mid and high frequencies. So you wouldn't use that at reflection points, but you can put that in corners that are out of the way, and you get more base trapping from that. So that's also a big feature that the other companies don't have.
Well, no,
but they're all made the same. Testing is really expensive. When we started doing this almost 20 years ago, we had to pay $400 per test. And we've tested, I don't know, maybe 4 or 5 things, different products. But now it's like, you know, almost $2,000, $1,500, something like that. I wanted to, the IBM has their own anechoic chamber and reverb room for testing these things. And I wanted to do a personal experiment. And I know the guys there because we've been there, I could say 4, 5, 6 times. I said, gee, I just want to listen to some music on a boombox in your anechoic chamber. Everybody says a totally dead room, totally dead, is awful. Can I just bring some speakers? I just want to sit there and just listen so I can experience it. And now I asked management, and now we'd have to charge you $1,400. So, anyways, testing is very expensive. And it's the same with fire testing. We tested our mini traps, and that was very, very expensive. We had to ship 8 of them or 4 of them to the lab in Texas and pay for the tests, but they're all made the same. And I can explain about the Class A fire rating because it's the main thing that's in there is rigid fiberglass. It doesn't burn. The metal doesn't burn and the fabric flashes. When I talked to the woman who runs the lab in Texas, and this was, you know, pushing 20 years ago, she said, well, I can tell you, I'm sure you'll get the Class A rating because there's no wood in there. There's nothing that's going to smoke or smolder or continue to burn for 20 minutes. I think that's how long they have to try to keep the fire going. They said the fabric will flash in 1 second and the rest will just sit there. And that's exactly what happened. So all of our other things are made exactly the same. You know, and I've had people ask, it doesn't come up often, but somebody will ask. I said, well, look, the Class A fire rating certificate for this applies to that. And it's the same with testing. We've tested the 1-inch, 3-inch, 4-inch panels and our big corner traps and, you know, a couple things.
All the frames are metal, you said? They're not wood?
They're metal. So they don't warp over time. They don't get weird if it gets, you know, in humid weather. They don't shift around.
That's very good than some of the competitors, right?
Yes. Yeah. I think everybody else uses wood or plastic. One of them uses plastic drywall bead. But it works fine. And, you know, earlier when you were saying what reasons would somebody have to buy from our competitors, And I have no problem telling somebody, and I've told people this by email, you know, they say, what do I need? So, well, you know, a room that size, you really need like our standard room kit, which is 8 base traps and 3 micro traps for, you know, for reflections. And that's, you know whatever the price, you know, a couple grand. Oh, I can't spend anything like that. So, well, yeah, you got to go to GIK or go to, whether there's a couple of other affordable places.
Right.
And I don't mind that, you're not going to get the same level of advice from me. The products won't be as good, but they work. You know, it works. If people criticize foam and say, oh, foam is a lousy material, it's not a lousy material. The problem with foam is it's too small and it's too thin. The base wraps, as I said before, are not wide enough. And sculpted foam, which is usually what you see, it's either pyramids or the wedge stuff. If it's a 1-inch slab of foam that they start with, they cut it with a razor wire. Or a heated wire, I'm not sure how they do it. And right. Now you have two halves whose average is 1/2 inch thick. So even if you get to 2-inch foam, it's really only 1 inch thick on average. So that's really the problem with foam, where we have base traps up to 6 inches thick. And we do have one product that has a wooden frame, which is the Mega Traps. Those are really, really big. And we have a local wood shop do that. And we may actually go to plastic at some point with that, looking into that.
Why are those wood and not metal? Can they
just because of the shape and the way it has to be put together? Probably could be made out of metal. My former partner Doug is the one who came up with that originally, and there's some wood place right down the road from our factory, and we went there and they said, "Oh yeah, we can make this for you for however much a piece." And,
gotcha. How much longer do you think you'll be involved in Real Traps for?
Well, probably until I die, And like I said, Sean is great, but he can't do what I do. At some point, if I say I don't want to do this anymore, I'll find somebody. There are lots of people. I know lots of people. I'd find some young upstart that is willing to work for minimum wage. No. I don't make a lot of money. I get Social Security. That's Real Traps, adds to that. I do these, as I said, these $200 flat rate consulting, a couple of those a month. And I don't mind talking about money. Everybody says that, it's rude to talk about religion, politics, or money. Those are the most interesting things to talk about.
They are. However, I try to be somewhat neutral, just to not put myself or anybody else in a bad position.
I don't mind that kind of stuff. And I tell you, the price is probably the most important spec for anything you buy.
Absolutely.
Whether it's a car or a preamp or a microphone.
Sure. I mean, if you say one day that you're done doing this for Sean now, certainly he can find someone. So Real Traps will continue, correct?
Oh, yeah. There'd be... I know a bunch of people.
Okay.
Probably like to have this job. I have more than 5,000 friends and followers on Facebook, and most of them are music, audio, recording types.
Right.
If I put up something on my Facebook page saying I'm going to retire, who would like my job? I get 100 private messages, so that's not an issue.
I know that you used to spend some time on some of the online audio forums, and you seem to have removed yourself from that. Is that due to lack of time or lack of trying to say the same thing over and over and over and getting nowhere?
Well, a lot of it is just because of bad management at those places. I have an article again on my personal site, and I have reasons if it's pure acoustics, it goes on the Real Traps. If it's opinion and or problems I have with audio forums, that's not Real Traps business. I have one called The Trouble with Audio Forums, and I name names and talk about very specific stuff and some really bad experiences at Gear Slots and some other places where the moderators were themselves idiots. And, they would see my name over and over again because somebody would say, you got to spend this much money per channel to get pro results. You don't spend at least a grand a channel on a preamp and at least a grand a channel on a converter, you'll never get pro results. And I would say, that's not true. You assess these things by their fidelity, by the distortion, frequency response, and noise. And, And that's how you assess fidelity. And now these days, you get a $100 sound card that is absolutely audibly transparent, meaning it doesn't have a sound. So it's going to sound exactly as good as the $2,000 per channel stuff. And so just a big fight would start, you know, and the moderators would get tired of seeing my name. So they figured it was easier just to ban me or criticize me and tell me to cut it out. And, you know, so screw them, you know. But also once I started on Facebook, they have the same kind of, I've been kicked out of groups there too for telling people, no, you need bass traps. You really do. You know? Right.
Are there any audio forms that you do think do a great job at proving science or that are open to science?
Well, there's the Audio Science Review, run by Amir, who used to work for Microsoft. And he and I agree on almost everything, though he is behind me in acoustics. I don't mean he backs me up. I mean, I've tried to explain to him. And I don't post there either because I had some bad experiences. But it's mostly time. I waste enough time on Facebook. There's a lot of groups there, and most of them, at least all of them, the ones I still post at, appreciate me. And there's a couple others. There's one called Audio Bullshit on Facebook. That's pretty good. Though I get tired of it because people just keep posting pictures of $20,000 speaker wires and for everybody to laugh at. All right, yes, we all know that there's idiots out there that will buy that.
Ethan, do you have any projects coming up that you're working on that you would like to share here?
Well, I'll tell you what I've been working on for a couple of months. I mentioned at the beginning of our conversation that when I was in my early 20s, late teens, early 20s, I would build fuzz tones in compressors and little gadgets. And I used to make them on a little tiny plastic piece, like an inch by 3/4 of an inch. I would actually take the plastic lid of a coffee can and cut it with a scissors and poke holes in it with and put resistors and stuff. And I did that as a service. I probably sold 20 of them, 30 of them over the years to other guitar players, local musicians. And they would have a fuzz tone right in their guitar.
That's cool.
And I would hook it up to the pickup switch. So it would be, this pickup, and then the lead pickup with fuzz. And, it'd be resistors to pat it down so it didn't get louder. You could adjust the volume. And I somehow was talking about that half a year ago, in the last year on Facebook, and a bunch of people said, oh, I remember those were great. I said, geez, I had to resurrect that. In fact, I have one right here, and this is all
very neat. Yeah.
It's not going to be in focus, but it's all surface mount parts. Yeah. And it's the same circuit that I had built back then. And then I decided, I'd want to do something a little more ambitious and just another fuzz tone. There's a million ways to get distortion. So I was thinking, geez, I'd like to animate it a little bit with a little bit of filtering, just like, not like meow, 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 like a wah wah, but just as you play higher notes, just to shift like a pair of filters, what called formant filters that sort of give a vocal quality, just so it add a little character and just be a little more. So then I started looking at voltage-controlled filters. I have two. I've told you I had mentors all my life, and I have two really, really genius people, Bill and Julia. She's one of the best engineers in the world. She's just amazing. And both of these people helped me with these projects. And then I realized, geez, I could take this. The problem with fuzz tones. Then Bill showed me a way to get an octave higher and octave lower, which is standard stuff. But you can't do that with a guitar signal. It's the holy grail of guitar synthesizers is getting a clean capture where it doesn't jump up and down the octaves unpredictably. And it's really, really hard. So what you need to do is, first thing you have to do is filter the guitar to a pure sine wave. And then once you have that, then you can do anything. So I started working on that and ended up, and this is what I was doing just before I talked to you, with a 36 dB per octave filter that sweeps and as you play different notes, it kind of tracks. And then I realized, well, geez, I could then make a real synthesizer with a frequency to voltage converter, and I could make basically a mini mode, you know, a mono synth, but only one note at a time. It's not going to handle chords, but basically a mini Moog, and that wouldn't be built into your guitar. It'd probably be a circuit board this big, you know.
Sure.
So that's what I'm doing now. Is this, and I've been on this now for a couple of months, and you know, as it has progressed from this to this idea to this idea, and so that's what I've been doing for the last several weeks, and that's my hope. And it's I'm close to having this tracking filter work perfectly. That's the key to the whole thing.
And will that be a commercially available product?
Yeah. I think that would be, it would be fun to start another business and or license it to somebody. You know, find, you know, if I have something, come up with something that's patentable, or if I can find a reputable company that I trust enough.
And would it just be something outboard to your guitar and amp, basically, and with a switch or bipedal or?
I think it would have to be a box, because if you look at a mini Moog, it's got a lot of knobs. It's got filter resonance and starting frequency, ADSR, four knobs just for that, a low frequency oscillator. And how, you know, does the oscillator start right away adding vibrato, or does it wait half a second and then bring in the vibrato? So there's going to be, you know, 20 knobs, you know. So I think it would have to be a box. If I end up going all out, you know, and making like a full mini Moog type synthesizer. And I've done that. I actually have schematics for all of this. If I had known, I would have could have prepared. Well, this is actually all on my website. There's a music and bio or history bio page where I have pictures of this really nice synthesizer I made with a friend who, that's when I really learned about electronics and op amps and all that. That was in the, also in the 70s. And we made, it was basically two mini Moogs in one box. So you could actually play two notes and had a split point you could program. You could set it to middle C, and everything above middle C would play through one mini Moog kind of clone. And,
Ethan, is there anything that I haven't asked you that you'd like to share, or that you wish I would have asked?
No, you have asked great questions. This has been, I've done several of these kinds of interviews, and you've been good. The last one I did, I'd be right in the middle of the thought, and the interviewer would just cut me off and start, "Oh yeah, I know what you mean." But, you know, I'm like, "Just shut up and let me talk." Yeah, and I know I can go on and on and on, maybe a little too much, but I try to stay focused. No, we've hit the high points. We hit the importance of acoustics, and that's more important than anything. All the preamps sound the same. All the DACs sound the same. All the receivers sound the same. Really, they differ by features. And, you know, these days, the last 10, 20 years, and loudspeakers have gotten really, really good. Even, you know, the $80 bookshelves are really good, much better than what they had, you know, 40 years ago. I mean, absolutely. Much better tweeters, better woofers, better, you know, stuff. So, yeah, we've hit that. And and I like doing this stuff, you know, like.
Great. Well, for everybody out there, please go check out ethanweiner.com. And if you want to get a hold of Ethan, certainly you can reach him through his website. Or if you're interested in realtraps.com, he obviously answers the 800 number there. So you can speak with him there and bother him for some room acoustic treatments if you wish. Ethan, thank you so much. You've been gracious with your time. I do much appreciate it.
Okay. And actually, let me just say one other thing.
Please.
I don't know if we mentioned my audio expert book, because that's really what, that's everything I know. It's 808 pages. I mean, it's a huge book, and it explains not only how to use all the stuff and how to connect things, how to set up a room, but actually explains how these things work inside in plain English. No math, no, you know, or minimal, really minimal math. There's nothing like it. It's on Amazon. My website has a really detailed description of all the stuff that's in there.
Link below. Thank you so much, Ethan. I do appreciate it. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening. Find us on YouTube and Facebook at the Intellectual People Podcast and online at theintellectualpeoplepodcast.com. Check back for exciting new episodes.